from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It has been a painful stretch in this country as we become more and more aware of how many black men, often unarmed, often on routine traffic stops, wind up dead from a policeman's gun. It's been painful all over again this past week and more as three policemen walked away from their trials free men. Even though the killings were videotaped, and even though many people, including police, have raised deep questions about the justice, if there is any, of those deaths, what are we as a country doing wrong here? This hour on Point, police shooting black men and walking free. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What did you think when you heard the verdicts out of Milwaukee and St. Paul, the hung jury in Cincinnati? When we all see super questionable killings on videotape, are we complicit if we don't fix it? It has been a tough parade of outcomes. Here was a report on ABC News World News Tonight, July 16th, reporting June from St. Paul, Minnesota, on the jury's verdict in the trial of Geronimo Yanez for the killing of Philando Castile.
Tonight, a family outraged after a Minnesota jury acquitted the officer who fatally shot Philando Castile moments before this infamous video was live streamed on Facebook by his girlfriend.
He's licensed to carry. He was trying to get out his ID and his wallet out his pocket.
So much video. More came after that jury result and so many questions. University of Cincinnati police officer Ray Tensing was tried twice for the 2015 of Sam DuBose, an unarmed 43-year-old black man, father of 13. And last week, for the second time, a mistrial was declared. By the way, it wasn't one or two holdout jurors who caused the deadlock. The jury was evenly split. Here's a bit from that shooting and the latest, the talk after the trial aftermath.
You ever license on you?
What some see as a clear case of excessive force, former University of Cincinnati police officer Ray Tensing opening fire on unarmed driver Sam DuBose has once again confounded an Ohio jury, the case ending in a mistrial for the second time, as prosecutors argue Tensing claimed he was in danger.
And last week also, former Milwaukee police officer Dominique Hagen-Brown found not guilty of first-degree reckless homicide for the shooting of 23-year-old Sylvel Smith at a traffic stop. Here's the sound of the judge reading out the jury's verdict of not guilty. You'll hear people in the room start to sob as the verdict sinks in.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Dominique Hagen-Brown, not guilty. Signed, the foreperson, dated this 21st day of June. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for your jury service in this matter.
And here was Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton. This was last year at a press conference in the wake of Philando Castile's death.
Nobody should be shot and killed in Minnesota for a traffic taillight being out of function. Nobody should be shot and killed while their seat is still in their car. Would this have happened if those passengers, the driver and the passengers, were white? I don't think it would have. So I'm forced to confront, and I think all of us in Minnesota are forced to confront, that this kind of racism exists.
They're the governor of Minnesota after the Philando Castile shooting. Joining me first today from Philadelphia is Nicole Gonzalez-Van Cleve. She teaches at Temple University's Department of Criminal Justice and its School of Law. Nicole Van Cleve, welcome to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This didn't happen yesterday, but we just can't shake it off. These weren't the first. We probably know very well they won't be the last. But we see this again and again and again, and we're almost paralyzed with not knowing how to understand how to take on board what keeps happening and why, and how to do something about it. As these most recent three jury trial outcomes sink in, how are you looking at where we stand on this problem, Nicole?
You know, I feel that, you know, that what we've described and heard just now is largely an experience of just citizens of color. And so if you're white and stopped by an officer, you largely do not fear for your life in the way people of color do. You largely have not had these types of encounters or experiences. Yeah. And what we've seen on video is that compliance with officer direction, good jobs, being in some ways respectable, not that you should have to be respectable to live.
No, but still.
Doesn't save your life. And I think one of the chords that the Philando Castile case really struck is that this is a man that was textbook protocol by the book. He didn't do anything wrong. And the mere, you know, in some ways, even talking or coaching through the officer, helping the officer feel
officer,
safe.
Officer, I have a gun.
Right.
And I
have a gun. It's legal. Right? So you see Philando Castile being very sophisticated to kind of keep himself safe, but yet it didn't work. And so now, for me as a professor, when people ask me about racial disparity in the criminal justice system, and I would say it exists, they would be skeptical. Now they're asking different questions, which is, how is this happening? And I think what people don't understand is that prosecutors in America are largely, in some ways, accountable to the police. They depend on police officers in a way that's extremely toxic and unhealthy, because police officers are largely their witnesses on all cases. And so if prosecutors want to win and get promoted in their offices, they need convictions. And if they don't go along with police officers, even when their stories don't make sense, they are forced to either look the other way or become complicit in this. And it really begs the question, are these local prosecutors able to, in some ways, pursue justice against, in some ways, their best friends in the system, right? Is that even possible? And in Chicago, for instance, the Laquan McDonald case, you see them appointing a special prosecutor in a way saying, listen, the history here of an entrenched prosecutor and police officer is so pervasive that we need to appoint an outside accountability to make it seem or try to get the appearance of fairness here. And it's possibly working. Right now, yesterday they just indicted two more officers in the actual cover-up, in some ways saying that the code of silence is not just unethical, but it's actually illegal. So we're seeing some progress, but this is very slow. And if you are a victim and you hear the weeping families, you hear the daughter in those videos crying and sobbing that she wants her mother alive, you know, justice can't come any quicker. I mean, this is, in some ways, this is too slow.
But there's so much public examination now of videos. I mean, the Philando Castile case is just incredible, but in so many now, and we're staring at these things. You may be right that in some ways prosecutors are, answer to police in some ways, because there's a mutual dependency there. The police testify for them so often. But, you know, we're taught that sunlight is supposed to be the best disinfectant here. And we are seeing a lot of these things and the apparent injustice of a lot of these decisions now. Doesn't the weight of that come down to bear on the prosecutors, the handling of these cases, the judges, the juries?
Yes. I mean, I guess, you know, for me, the Philando Castile case was very eye-opening. I guess the three of these cases all happening at the same time. You know, it's one thing to understand what implicit bias is by police, meaning the officer that shot Philando Castile, he, quote unquote, thought he saw a gun when it was really a wallet, for instance. Mm. That's kind of a cognitive malfunction. It's how racial bias is in our brains, if you will. And in some ways, you know, we saw the testimony where the officer is saying, you know, I smelled marijuana, so I felt fear. And that the implication is that marijuana plus the sight of a black man made him feel fear. And that fear then justified the level of force or the level or the killing. And the jury, in some ways, seemed to empathize with that. And I think that's when we need to really start discussing how racism and ideas of race or associating blackness and criminality has really infiltrated all of our psyches, right? You know, it would be unfair to just put racism and these kind of this racial history on the police. I think the fact that jurors are not seeing Philando Castile as a victim shows how deep race goes, right? The fact that he was stopped 46 times while driving, is he really the worst driver? Or is it, you know, beyond our comprehension to think of a black man working in a white neighborhood? Does that create a sense of fear amongst officers? I think that's what it comes down to. And these jurors, I think, again, we have to continue educating. So someone like me, I'm continuing to say that we need to kind of interrogate these issues. You know, why can't we see Philando Castile as a victim? And in the Obama era, we were living in this post-racial denial. The idea we could elect a black president meant, you know, this kind of sincere fiction that none of us then could be prejudiced. And what we're seeing then is a resurgence of the level of overt racism. But I think these juries were seeing a consistent presence of the level of kind of subtle racism that's just in our psyches and it's difficult to shed.
I mean, you talk about, and of course the prosecutors talk about, the fear that policemen feel. And of course, these can be really fraught circumstances, though in some of these cases, it's as though they created the circumstance. It didn't look that fraught, but okay. I mean, I'm not the guy there, you know, approaching the car, and we can understand that fear. But there's another kind of fear here that people have been talking about, and that is the fear that is then therefore required of people of color just walking around, and the fear that they could end up dead even if they haven't done anything, maybe a tail light out, or even if they're complying in every way, even in a fairly sophisticated way. And it's left people wondering if this is a lethal threat, if this is somehow baked into racial lines, even a kind of racial dominance structure that is, sustained in this country.
Yeah, I mean, think about what Philando Castile went through before he died. To be stopped 46 times because you're driving to work. Can you imagine that? If all the listeners out there that are, that are not people of color, don't feel that this defines their experience, imagine that 46 times, right? And I think, and then every time to have some level of risk about whether you'll be safe in those encounters. You know, I think it really speaks to, one of the larger issues that criminal justice scholars think about, which is this criminalization of everyday life, meaning we are criminalizing more aspects of small parts of life, like the broken taillight or Eric Gardner, in some ways selling those loose cigarettes, right? And so those tiny crimes that don't seem very consequential become absolute encounters that are terrifying to people of color because it keeps them vulnerable. It justifies constantly being stopped and bothered and harassed when you're just trying to live your everyday life. You have to kind of plan around it.
We are taking it up right here and right now. The problem we cannot shake: police shooting Black Americans and walking, even after we've all seen video that can look so damning. Nicole Gonzalez-Van Cleve is with us from Temple University and Beasley School of Law there, and from Philadelphia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the problem we cannot shake: police shooting Black Americans and walking. Even after these days, we've all seen video that looks so damning, we're trying to look at the core of what is happening here and how to change it. You can join us this hour. Are you still thinking about the three cases that were so much in the news last week, all those that came before them, all the video we've seen? Do we somehow give our police and respect to the work that they do, respect for the fear that they feel and the threats that they're up against, but do we somehow give them a license to kill that's based on race? And if that's true, how do we pull the license? Nicole Gonzalez-Van Cleve is with us from Philadelphia at the Beasley School of Law at Temple University. I want to listen back to just some of the cases that have been in the news. This is the body cam video of that University of Cincinnati police officer, again, Ray Tensing, shooting Sam DeVos in that traffic stop in 2015, last week, again, no conviction there. Some back and forth. Tensing opens the car door, orders DeVos to get out. DeVos starts to drive off, maybe. Tensing shoots him once in the head. The car careens down the street, apparently out of control, then crashes.
Well, until I can figure out if you have a license or not, go ahead and take your seatbelt off for me.
I didn't even do that.
Go ahead and take your seatbelt off. Stop.
Boom. Bang. Bang. And then that extremely upsetting dash cam footage from just last week. This is Officer Geronimo Yanez fatally shooting Philando Castile 7 times last July in front of his girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, and her child. Yanez acquitted of all charges on June 16th.
I have to tell you, I do have a firearm on me.
Don't reach for it, then.
He was saying, Philando Castile, I don't have to pull it out. He wasn't, I'm not pulling it out. But after the acquittal, his mother, Valerie, said outside the court, she was disappointed in the state of Minnesota.
My son loved this state. He had one tattoo on his body, and it was of the Twin Cities, the state of Minnesota with TC on it. My son loved this city, and this city killed my son, and the murderer gets away. Are you kidding me right now? We're not evolving as a civilization. We're devolving. We have taken steps forward. People have died for us to have these rights. And now we're devolving. We're going back down to 1969.
Philando Castile's mother, Valerie, we are not evolving as a civilization. We're devolving. Certainly haven't solved the problem. Nicole Gonzalez-Van Cleve, please stand by in Philadelphia. With us now from Houston, Texas, Charles McClelland. He joined the Houston Police Force in 1977, was chief of police from 2010 through 2016. Charles McClellan, thank you very much for joining us from Houston today.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. And from Gainesville, Florida, Ibram X. Kendi joins us, teaches African-American history at the University of Florida, Gainesville. Will teach history and international relations at American University in Washington. He had an op-ed piece last week in New York Times, headline, Sacrificing Black Lives for the American Lie. You can read it at our website, onpointradio.org. Ibram Kendi, Professor Kendi, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
You wrote very powerfully that you see race and racism fundamentally at work in these killings. Describe what you see, Ibram Kendi.
Well, I mean, particularly after the Castile verdict, I think, like many Americans, was trying to figure out how could this be? How could these jurors look at the facts of this case and come to a conclusion that this police officer did nothing wrong? And I began to realize that these jurors are, of course, members of our society, and they've been involved in this long debate over race, and that many Americans have been led to believe that we're living in a post-racial society. And so for them, this police officer isn't just on trial. America is on trial. And for them to say that these deaths are unjustified is simultaneously saying that their nation is not just. And so I made the case in that piece that really people are defending these police officers because they're defending America, because they've been led to believe and want to believe that racism is no more. And by admitting that these officers and the criminal justice system that they're operating in is racist, they would then have to admit that America is racist, which they do not want to do.
Charles McClellan, you had to work on the front lines of this, and for a long time, as an African-American man yourself, and, you know, you saw what happened in Dallas after the Baton Rouge killing last year, Alton Sterling and the five police officers who died in Dallas. You had years of overseeing your own department there. This is must have been a very real and present issue for you. Are you prepared to say this too often or fundamentally boils down to issues of race? How do you look at it, sir?
Well, the way that I look at it is certainly from two perspectives. One, yes, there is racism in law enforcement. There's racism in our criminal justice system, and there's racism in our society, all phases and aspects of that. Mm-hmm. But also, there is a fundamental need for improved training in several key areas that law enforcement executives must recognize and be leaders, because some of these videos that we have seen are very, very horrific. And I'll just speak broadly here, because I don't know all the evidence that each jury panel heard, you know, in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. But this is one of the imperfect, you know, aspects of our criminal justice system. These officers were indicted. Prosecutors did bring charges against them, but a jury of their peers, which is a generic term of art, in my opinion, decided that they were not guilty or couldn't reach a conclusion. And I think a lot of that, and I can speak for my state of Texas, the laws are very, very broad in giving police authority and powers to protect themselves. And basically, it only requires the officer to believe that he's in fear of his or her life. Don't have to be armed with anything. But I do think that these videos are validating what many folks in the community have complained about over the years that now we're seeing on video. But videos also are not depicting the hundreds and thousands of arrests that police officers make every single day, disarming violent criminals without using deadly force.
Yes. When you say, Charles McClellan, with your experience as police chief there in Houston, that in these videos you're seeing horrific policing, if I hear you right, sometimes, like what are the problems that you see?
Well, the professor spoke about implicit bias. And police executives must make sure that their officers are properly trained to actually reduce implicit bias. We all have some bias,
yep.
stereotypes that we bring to the job. During the recruiting and hiring phase, most police departments are trying to screen for explicit bias. But those unconscious biases that, you know, we have formulated through our experience, years of just living, it's very, very hard to detect that in a recruit. And officers are taught in the police academy, and I think overly taught, that every situation is life or death, and it's not. Until they gain a certain baseline level of experience, all encounters, even with violent criminals, are not life and death. Officers are making poor decisions based on implicit bias and putting themselves in a position where they're making bad decisions and using poor judgment.
Can you give us an example of that from the videos that the whole country has seen lately? Take the Philando Castile video.
Yes. To me, that officer was improperly trained just from looking at the video.
What's the evidence in the video? What's the evidence? Yes. What was wrong?
Well, one, when he perceived any fear or threat to him, he never moved. He stood right in front of the door, right in front of Mr. Castillo.
Mm-hmm.
He should have tried to de-escalate or did a strategic retreat. Officers are taught,
mm-hmm.
maintain cover and concealment. If he would have retreated to the rear of the car and gave Mr. Castillo orders to get out with your hands up, it may have been a different result. But he stood there, and because he made a bad decision to stand there and place himself in what he perceived as danger, then he had to make another bad decision to use deadly force.
When you've watched that now, we've all watched it, and now last week, you know, we saw even more. Before it was Diamond Reynolds' own video from inside the car. That was bad enough, but now we've seen from the outside. Can you get inside his head and see how he could have legitimately been in fear for his life, or do you look at that as a longtime policeman, police chief in Houston, and say, what in the name of God was he doing shooting like that seven times?
Well, look. You know, I was a street officer back in the 70s and came up through the ranks in the Houston Police Department.
Yeah.
And every single day that I worked the streets, at some point in time, I was in fear of my life. But that doesn't mean that I had to use deadly force. Officers are in fear of their life all the time. The job is inherently dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But with proper training and good decision-making, good judgment, it doesn't mean that just because you're legally allowed to use deadly force doesn't mean that you have to.
Nicole Gonzalez Van Cleef. Oh, I'm sorry.
And that's Chief. What, you know, very, very troubling to the general public, that sometimes you may see something on video that's very, very horrific, but it doesn't mean that the officer committed a crime. Now, I'm not saying the Castillo or these other recent videos doesn't show a crime, because I believe that they should have been able to gain conviction from those cases.
They didn't get them. Nicole Gonzalez Van Cleef, you're listening to this. When you look at the context for these killings and you hear Charles McClellan, with all his experience, say we need improved training, how does that hit your ear, your mind? Can we train our way out of this, or is this something bigger than operational police training that's at work here, Nicole?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think when you saw the Department of Justice's report looking at Chicago, I mean, they were using training videos that were so outdated it was laughable, except the fact that it was violent and killing people. So that's certainly, you know, one way that we can improve things is improve training. But, you know, the officer talked about this implicit bias, right? How do you screen for it? But
mm-hmm.
from my experience researching police for, you know, a decade, is that there was also explicit bias that was in some ways learned on the job. You know, in Chicago, overtly calling black men dogs and everything short of the N-word, torturing
When you worked
them.
In the court system, then you,
yes.
you saw
and,
that
And I heard it.
Language.
Right, you would think
it.
The courts would be a place of decorum, but what I found is I could research the police and just talk to them and interview them while they were in the courts, and they were very candid with me about the level of racism they had. In fact, I was so young that they were trying to train me to not see the defendants as people. You know, that guy's a dog. He's not really. And so they'd refrain. But we also saw in Baltimore driving Freddie Gray around in the back of a car until his spine broke. We saw Eric Gardner begging for his life. I mean, that's not the Philando Castile shooting where he, you know, quickly reacts. Those are calculated cultural things, meaning you have to make a choice to choke Eric Gardner. And when he's begging for his life, you have to continue to make that choice over and over again with other officers watching you and not stopping you, right? Same thing, Laquan McDonald, shot 16 times. He was dead, that young man, right? To the head and to the neck were the first two shots. The rest was, in some ways, for recreation, it seemed. And all the other officers kind of participating in that. I think that type of explicit bias, we have to wonder, how is it possible that trainees that come in don't have that necessarily? It doesn't seem to be measured, but yet they're accumulating it with the type of experience they have. And I think that, to me, is one of the key issues, is addressing that culture. And part of it is breaking up that kind of culture of silence that's been happening. And in no other place can we have a culture of silence like that, where it's just okay to have a suspect that's dead and we don't really interrogate those stories and find out how it actually happened.
Ibrahim Kendi, you're listening. Do you think we can train our way out of this? This is clearly important. I mean, I don't challenge the chief's experience for a second here. That it's vital. But can we train our way out of it? Or is training undermined by race and racism? Even the best training, there's a context. There's a surround.
Well, I think to add to what was just stated, you know, I wrote a book on the history of racist ideas that chronicled racist ideas from their origins to the present, called Stamped from the Beginning.
Yep.
And never once in that book did I use the term implicit or explicit. You know, I chronicled ideas that people have produced and other people have consumed. And I think one of the most dangerous racist ideas that police officers have, just like non-police officers have, is the idea of the dangerous black neighborhood with dangerous people. And so if you have that idea, as many officers probably do, and I don't know if they're being screened for whether they have that idea when they're, you know, basically seeking to become a police officer. If you have that idea, right, that's going to cause you to feel more fearful when you're around black bodies, when you're policing black communities.
Is now, it a crazy course, idea? People would say, look at the crime rates.
Well, the crime rates, so there's two ways people defend it. First, they talk about crime in general. But then they specifically want to talk about violent crime. And so crime rates in general, I mean, crime statistics are based on arrest and incarceration rates, generally speaking. And so the assumption is that if we're arresting a lot of people in this community, there must be more people in this community, there must be more crime. Well, we all know that there are people who commit crimes every day and are not arrested, just like there are people who are arrested and who are not incarcerated. So for us to make this straight line between arrest and incarceration rates to higher crime rates does not really make much sense. And then as far as violent crime, to make this case that black communities are violent or black communities are dangerous, well, why is there not a similar level of violent crime in black middle-income neighborhoods, in black upper-income neighborhoods? Well, we actually see similar levels of violent crime among poorer neighborhoods, no matter the racial group. So we like to think of this idea of the dangerous black neighborhood when it's actually more statistically appropriate to call it a dangerous unemployed neighborhood because there are direct correlations between unemployment rates and violent crime. But then that would cause us to think differently about how to fight violent crime, right? It wouldn't be putting more police officers on the street with more guns, with more fears. It would be bringing jobs.
Ibrahim Kendi is with us from Gainesville, Florida. He's author of Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. Charles McClellan joins us from Houston, Texas, former chief of police at the Houston Police Department until just last year. Nicole Gonzalez Van Cleve is with us from Temple University Beasley School of Law there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the problem we can't shake, apparently. Police shooting black Americans and walking, even after we've all seen video that looks so damning. With us today, Charles McClelland. He was chief of police in Houston, Texas, until just last year. Long-time policeman. Joined the force there in 1977. He knows of what he speaks. Ibram X. Kendi is with us. Teaches African-American history at the University of Florida, Gainesville. Author of Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. And he says, look for those, even in this arena, even in this problem, of course. Nicole Gonzalez-Van Cleve joins us from the Beasley School of Law at Temple University, author of Crook County, Racism and Injustice in America's Criminal Courts. Eric in Nashville, Tennessee. Eric, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and other guests.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that my hearts go out to all the family members of these issues. And I just had a comment as a brown person living in Nashville,
yep,
who is a concealed carry permit person. I have a concealed carry permit to carry. And when I am pulled over, have been periodically, I follow a particular pattern. I immediately turn off my vehicle, put my keys on the dashboard, pull out both my concealed carry permit and my driver's license,
yep,
hand that to the officer. And this has happened probably three times. And so doing that, my comment was just, you know, what are the laws and the protocols for an individual that's getting, you know, pulled over? I haven't had an issue and haven't been shot. And I can say that the only thing, I guess my comment would be, is with the Philando Castile, you know, saying that I have a gun and then reaching for your wallet when it's somewhat dark, maybe a little difficult for an officer to see. And then with the DeBose case, the individual has his hands on the, you know, on the car, starts the vehicle. And so I'm not blaming the victims. I'm just saying that I go out of my way to follow a particular protocol with regard to my concealed carry permit. And the officer usually unloads the weapon, checks the serial number. And so perhaps your guests, particularly the officer,
yes,
could comment on, you know, what individuals should do when they do have a gun, if I'm doing it correctly or not. I think that, you know, you can just go out and buy a gun and in an hour have a gun, but we don't really talk about what it, you know, how to interact with the police officer,
yeah, yeah,
when you have a weapon.
And not least, as you say, Eric, as a brown person, I mean, that's what's on the table right here. I appreciate your call and question. Charles McClelland, I mean, talk about, Eric calls it protocol. He's got a concealed carry permit. He carries a weapon. So he's driving, he's a brown person. He's driving along in kind of Philando Castile territory, but you heard his regimen when he's pulled over, how he does it. I mean, how perfect does the citizen have to be here? What's incumbent on the officer to work out? What do you advise?
Well, it sounds like the caller here from Nashville is following a good procedure or protocol. In the state of Texas, if you have a permit to carry a handgun, you are required that when you approach or stop by the police officer, you must immediately tell the officer, in the fashion that Mr. Castillo was doing, you must tell him that you're carrying a weapon, where it's located, and then you're supposed to follow the officer's instructions. Now, having said that, very few people in America in real life comply perfectly. And that does not mean or give justification for an officer to use deadly force. Some people want to question, why are you stopping me? What did I do wrong? They may not comply perfectly. But the citizen is not trained. The officer is. And that's why it's incumbent upon the police officer to use good judgment and good decision-making.
I mean, to be perfect every time is a good idea, but you can come pretty close and still be in trouble. I mean, just this week, Charlotte, North Carolina Citizens Review Board said that the police department review there of the 2016 police shooting of Keith Scott had substantial evidence of error. The police found the shooting justified. Last fall, we heard 9-year-old Charlotte resident Ziana Oliphant giving an emotional speech at the city council meeting there on police killings, and that video went viral.
We are black people, and we shouldn't have to feel like this. We shouldn't have to protest because y'all are treating us wrong. We do this because we need to and have rights.
We do this because we need to and have rights. I mean, it's upsetting for everybody, for an 8-year-old, kind of terrifying. Beverly in Watertown, Massachusetts, thank you for calling, Beverly. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, panel. This has been a fascinating discussion. I want to say one thing very clearly.
Yes, ma'am.
Do not look at police practices, at our training as the source. Look at the actual, genuine, historical source, which is racism in this country. In around the mid-18th century in this country, according to a renowned historian, the ratio of blacks to whites starting in Maryland and going south was one black person to two white people. Those are not great odds if you're a white person who is fearful. The other thing I want to say is that hearing the police video from the Philando Castile murder confirmed something that I had thought from the moment I heard about this murder, which is, if you listen to the tone of voice of Mr. Castile, along with the content of the words he said.
Sir, I have to tell you, I do have a firearm on me. I don't have to pull it out.
He was trying to help the police.
Yes, he was. To me, it sounds that way.
To not scare the policeman, because if the policeman, say, perhaps had searched him or come upon that gun without forewarning, he would have been frightened. The problem is that most white people in this country cannot conceive of the possibility that black people are indeed people, humane, decent, nonviolent, compassionate, intelligent, caring, patriotic. I could go on, but please understand root cause. White policemen, period, of any color, need to learn how to overcome enough of their fear so that they can take in and listen to what a black person is saying.
Beverly, thank you very much for your call. Ibram, Kendi, if that fear is there and it's baked in, how do we break it?
Well, I think we have to, as a nation and as individuals and as institutions, first confess our racist ideas, first recognize the racist policies that persist in our institutions that actually cause the racial disparity. So last year, young black men were 9 times more likely to be killed by police than other groups in this country. And then the question becomes, why? Why is that the case? And those who produce racist ideas tell us there's something wrong with those young black men. There's something wrong that Castile did. There's something wrong that these other people did, when in fact, it's racial discrimination. It's racist ideas. And so we as a nation have to recognize that. But we also, in a greater sense, have to recognize that there's actually historically been self-interest behind the development and the persistence of these policies and of these ideas. Think about it. For a police officer to have the ability to shoot to kill whenever they fear and have the ability to get off, like that bar being so low, I mean, that's in the best interest of the police officer as opposed to Americans. And so that clearly has to change, as well as many of the policies that have led to the mass incarceration of black bodies, of the killing of black people, of the criminalization of black people. You know, the Castile case, Castile was 2 years younger than me. Actually, I think we were about the same age when he was killed. Mm-hmm. He wears locks. I wear locks. Mm-hmm. I oftentimes can tell that white people or even other black people are fearful because of me. And so I try to go out of my way to try to reduce their fears in the way that Castile did with the police officer. But he ended up dead. And I know that that could be me or many of the listeners who are listening to this, because that's the world that we live in. And we still have so many people still imagining that we live in a post-racial society.
Susan in Owensboro, Kentucky. Susan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm a white woman. I have a black son-in-law and a grandchild who I'm fearful for all the time, but it's entitlement that these men feel when they kill people. They feel entitled to. In Owensboro, many years ago, we had a gentleman who killed his wife. He was a policeman. They let him go. Years later, he killed another wife with his gun, and he burned up three children of his.
Oh, Lord.
And then years, like maybe less than 10 years, this man's walking the streets again. It is entitlement. It's not about fear a lot of the time. It's about their rights.
Their right. Good Lord, that's a very, the right of the power of life and death is a pretty big one. Susan, you live it across the race line, and I appreciate your call with that. Let me get one more. Ann in Nashville. Ann, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hey, I am a white female, and I grew up actually in North St. Louis, for St. Ferguson area, and
Ferguson,
and really,
famous address.
No. Yeah. 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 And yeah. So I relocated to Nashville later on, to a Catholic worker house in North Nashville, and it took me until moving to North Nashville to realize that there is like a different. Like the police treated the area a bit different. And
it's a black neighborhood.
Yes, sorry. It's a primarily black neighborhood, lower income.
Yep.
And I was just appalled at, like, sometimes, like, no, okay, I do want to say I am very thankful for police, but sometimes they would speed through back roads 40 miles per hour and there's children playing. And I called the North Precinct and let them know that I was not happy with this, but it took me until moving there to realize that I had come from a stance of white privilege. And I'm just saying personally, it took me realizing that for myself to start changing and seeing that my worldview had been built around this, like, I think I had believed that maybe racism, I guess, had like, didn't exist anymore. And then when the Ferguson thing happened, it really blew apart my worldview, and as well as moving to North Nashville.
Yeah.
So I just want to say that it's just the police attitude. Living in North Nashville was hard for me to take in, and I have spoken up to the police here about that.
Experience is a great teacher. People do what they need to do or try to survive. The listener writes to us, when I was pulled over in Philadelphia, I would just toss my keys on top of my car, then hang my hands out of my window. That's one way to try and stay on the safe side here. Nicole Van Cleve, what about the fear? You know, if a policeman feels fear, and of course, I mean, we have to feel sympathy, empathy when they feel fear, but it's so subjective, and the right to kill on that basis. Is there a way to pull back the legal line here so that it's not quite as simple and prone to death as that?
Yeah, well, I think one thing that we haven't talked about is rallying the political will, if you will, of voters to start voting out prosecutors and put a cross check on the police. So, you know, in researching my book, Crook County, I was, you know, what I was seeing in the court system, it's America's largest court system. I saw these kind of everyday violations, this kind of flagrant abuse of power and overt racism. But what I didn't know is that, you know, since 2004, Chicago had paid out $662 million in police misconduct settlements, meaning we are, as a society, choosing to pay, if you will, an exorbitant amount of money to continue with this really violent status quo that subjugates a whole class of people. And so I think, you know, what we've seen that's a little bit different and shows some promise is in Philadelphia, Chicago, For instance, in Chicago, for instance, they voted out prosecutors in favor of reform-oriented prosecutors. And to me, that is a glimmering of hope, which is if we're not going to, you know, disentangle the prejudice that associates black men or blackness with criminality, if we can't do that, or if police departments across the nation continue to want to pay out this level of money, the cities— we can start to put in new people there, right? We can vote in new judges. We can vote in new prosecutors. And, you know, Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, he actually sued the police department several times. And the people in the city actually voted him in office to be the prosecutor. That speaks volumes, right? This is a person that actually went after bad police officers and made a statement. And people wanted him to be on the other side
there's one way to
perform the office.
I want to get to Chief McClellan before we run out of time here. Where do you see the hope, Chief, with your Houston experience?
Well, first of all, there is no one easy, simple solution to resolve this issue. I want to remind the listeners and our panel guests, every police agency and jurisdiction is different, yeah. although they may have some of the same responsibilities. But I can only speak for Texas and Houston. And the diversity and makeup and training of your organization matter. But Houston has been dubbed one of the most diverse cities in the United States. And when you hire young men and women that live in diverse neighborhoods, that have attended diverse schools, university, socialized interracially, dated interracially, you actually have a better culturally diverse police officer. But it's not this embryonic relationship that police have with prosecutors in all jurisdictions. Matter of fact, in Houston, it's an adversarial relationship because one of the things that I would hear from my rank and file constantly is prosecutors rejecting the charges of people that they arrest. Police officer wants everybody that they encounter or arrest charged with something. And that's not the case here in Houston, Texas, Harris County. So some jurisdictions, you may have that relationship to where they depend on each other, but that is not the case here in Harris County.
Chief McClellan, we've got it, and I appreciate it. We're up against the clock. Hope in our very diversity, if we embrace it. Very grateful to you, Charles McClellan, for being with us today from Houston. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
Ibram Kendi in Gainesville, Florida, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you for having me on.
And Nicole Gonzalez-Van Cleve in Philadelphia, thank you very much.
Thank you again.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.